from Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
Right now, unfortunately, it is a very one-sided and unfair one. But, I don't blame China.
On a five-country trip to Asia, President Trump is now in China. After a lavish welcome billed as a state visit plus, Trump focused on the trade deficit with a country he once accused of raping the United States and called for China to sever ties with North Korea. Chinese President Xi Jinping said he's open to dialogue.
Both sides will continue to strictly enact all UN Security Council resolutions. And at the same time, we are committed to continuing to solve the North Korean nuclear issue through dialogue and talks.
Then to Yemen, as Saudi Arabia seals off aid shipments amidst famine, war, and cholera.
This is a humanitarian crime. They are exterminating the Yemeni people, and no Muslim should be doing that. These are unjust operations. But it's not unexpected for those who kill children to close some ports.
We'll speak with award-winning independent Yemeni journalist Afra Nasser of the Sana Review. Facing death threats, she's in exile from Yemen, but continues to report on human rights violations, women's issues, and press freedom there. She's here in the U.S. to receive the International Free Press Award from the Committee to Protect Journalists. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump's begun talks with Chinese leader Xi Jinping in Beijing following a lavish welcome Wednesday that was billed as a state visit plus and included the first state dinner for a U.S. president inside the Forbidden City. The welcoming ceremony outside Beijing's Great Hall of the People was broadcast live on state television, unprecedented treatment for a visiting leader. Trump used the talks to call on China to sever ties with North Korea.
The United States is committed to the complete and permanent denuclearization of North Korea. So important. China can fix this problem easily and quickly. And I am calling on China and your great president to hopefully work on it very hard. I know one thing about your president. If he works on it hard, it will happen. There's no doubt about it. They know.
China insists it's already fully enforcing UN sanctions. Human rights activists and even Trump's fellow Republicans have urged him to use his trip to challenge China over its crackdown on dissidents and call for the release of political prisoners. Trump is on a five-nation tour in Asia, will next head to Vietnam, where he's expected to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Trump will wrap up his Asia trip in the Philippines. After headlines, we'll go to Beijing for more on Trump's visit to China. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee said Wednesday it'll hold hearings to review President Trump's power to start a nuclear war. The committee's chair, Republican Senator Bob Corker, says next week's hearing will be the first time since 1976 that the House has examined the president's authority to launch a nuclear first strike. The planned hearings come after Senator Corker repeatedly questioned whether Donald Trump is mentally fit to be president. Trump has repeatedly threatened to totally destroy North Korea and to unleash fire and fury on the nation of 25 million people. The Trump administration slapped tough new sanctions or restrictions on U.S. citizens visiting Cuba, barring Americans from staying at scores of hotels while blacklisting dozens of Cuban businesses. The move reverses much of President Obama's thaw in relations with Cuba. The restrictions will not end direct flights between the U.S. and Cuba, but will make it extremely difficult for Americans to travel individually to the island. The sanctions were immediately condemned by Cuban officials. This is Josefina Vidal of the Cuban Foreign Ministry.
Unilateral sanctions do not work. Unilateral sanctions affect people. They hurt people. So we are very opposed to unilateral sanctions, so you will never see the Cuban government adopting this kind of sanctions against other countries, other people, including the United States.
In Washington, D.C., the labor union representing Foreign Service employees warns the Trump administration is undermining U.S. diplomacy at a dizzying speed as it reduces the number of senior diplomatic positions while pressing a hiring freeze across the State Department. Since Trump took office, three of the State Department's five career ambassadors have retired or quit, and nearly half of career ministers, the next rank down, have also left. In a letter to members of the American Foreign Service Association this week, Ambassador Barbara Stevenson writes, quote, "The talent being shown the door now is not only our top talent, but also talent that cannot be replicated overnight. The rapid loss of so many senior officers has a serious, immediate, and tangible effect on the capacity of the United States to shape world events." A new report on U.S. inequality finds nation's wealthiest three men hold more wealth than the bottom half of Americans, more than 160 million people. The report from the Institute for Policy Studies, titled Billionaire Bonanza 2017, finds Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Warren Buffett hold a combined $248.5 billion, while the lowest 20% of U.S. households hold zero or negative wealth. Report authors Chuck Collins and Josh Hoxie warn, quote, "Over recent decades, an incredibly disproportionate share of America's income and wealth gains has flowed to the top of our economic spectrum," unquote. The findings come as Senate Republicans prepare to unveil their plan to cut taxes, a bill that's expected to balloon the national debt while slashing taxes on corporations and inherited wealth, showering most of its benefits on the wealthiest Americans. In Texas, Vice President Mike Pence met Wednesday with the families of victims of Sunday's massacre at the church in Sutherland Springs, in which shooter Devin Patrick Kelly used a semi-automatic assault rifle to kill 26 people while wounding 20 others. Kelly was able to purchase his rifle even though he'd been convicted by a military court on domestic abuse charges. Pence blamed mental illness and bureaucratic failures for the assault.
In just a few moments, we'll meet with families of the fallen and put our arms around them and assure them that every American has them in their hearts. It was a crime that the assailant was ever able to purchase a firearm in the first place. He lied on his application, had a history of mental illness, and there were bureaucratic failures.
Vice President Pence is a longtime NRA member with an A rating from the gun lobby. As a Congress member, he voted to block individuals from suing gun manufacturers, loosened rules on interstate purchases, and voted for national legislation that would have allowed gun owners to carry concealed weapons. Spain's government said Wednesday it'll consider constitutional changes that would allow for regional governments to hold referendums on independence, like the banned vote on October 1st that sparked a political crisis in Spain's Catalonia region. The apparent olive branch came as pro-independence activists called a general strike Wednesday. In Barcelona, riot police arrested students who stormed a train station and shut down high-speed rail service. Police also removed demonstrators who blockaded roads and highways across the city. This is Adriana, a Barcelona student, who said the protesters are demanding the release of Catalan political leaders who've been arrested on charges of rebellion and sedition.
In order to break with the picture of normalcy, as if nothing was happening here, to demand the freedom of the political prisoners and to keep on taking the streets, because the republic which has been declared needs to be defended. We need to stay organized and keep demonstrating.
Egypt's highest appeals court has upheld a sentence of 5 years in prison and 5 years probation for Alaa Abdel Fattah, one of the country's most prominent pro-democracy activists. The ruling's final and cannot be appealed. Al-Fattah has served 3.5 years of the sentence already, so will spend the next year and a half in prison. The probation means he will have to spend up to 12 hours a day in a police station for another 5 years once he's released. Al-Fattah was convicted of inciting a 2013 protest that broke a law barring public gatherings without government approval. He's also on trial in another case of insulting the judiciary, with a verdict scheduled in December. According to Human Rights Watch, the U.S.-backed government of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has arrested or charged at least 60,000 people, forcibly disappeared hundreds for months at a time, handed down preliminary death sentences to hundreds more, and sent more than 15,000 civilians to military courts. Back in the United States, a Black Lives Matter activist and citizen journalist whose protest photo went viral has been elected to serve on the City Council of Charlotte, North Carolina. The photo of Braxton Winston from last year shows him raising a fist in front of a line of riot police as he joined protests against the killing of Keith Lamont Scott. an African-American father who was shot by a Charlotte police officer who was later acquitted for the killing. Winston has promised to focus on economic development and police accountability. Meanwhile, voters in Northern Virginia have elected 30-year-old Democrat and Marine veteran Lee Carter to the State House of Delegates. Carter identifies as a Democratic socialist. He defeated longtime incumbent Republican Jackson Miller, the state's majority whip. In Texas, 47-year-old Mexican citizen Ruben Ramirez Cardenas died on Wednesday evening after prison officials injected him with a single lethal dose of the drug pentobarbital. Cardenas's execution came 2 decades after he was convicted of murdering his 16-year-old cousin. The execution came over the strong objections of Mexican diplomats who say Texas violated Cardenas's due process rights, failed to consider conflicting testimony by witnesses at his trial, and refused to allow new DNA testing. In Indiana, the University of Notre Dame has reversed a plan to stop covering birth control for faculty, staff and students following major protests at the Catholic University. Notre Dame's attempt to restrict contraceptive coverage came less than 1 month after the Trump administration sharply limited birth control coverage under the Affordable Care Act. In Hollywood, more than a dozen men have stepped forward, accusing actor Kevin Spacey of sexually harassing or assaulting them. The latest allegations came Wednesday as Boston TV news anchor Heather Unruh said Spacey sexually assaulted her son last year in a Nantucket bar.
It happened late night inside the Club Car restaurant and bar on Nantucket Island. The victim, my son, was a starstruck, straight, 18-year-old young man who had no idea that the famous actor was an alleged sexual predator or that he was about to become his next victim.
On Wednesday, director Ridley Scott said he's removing actor Kevin Spacey from the finished film All the Money in the World and will reshoot his scenes with Christopher Plummer taking Spacey's role. In Texas, an asylum seeker at the private all-women T. Don Hutto Detention Center says she was sexually assaulted by a guard and fears retaliation for speaking out. The woman alleges a female guard who worked in the recreation area groped her on repeated occasions. In a letter given to an advocate during visitation hours, the woman wrote, the guard, quote, took advantage of every moment she could touch my breasts or my legs, and, quote, what she did with me, she did with other residents. The group Grassroots Leadership reports the woman was treated with suspicion when sheriff's deputies interviewed her this week as immigration authorities looked on. About 500 women are held at Hutto, a jail run by Core Civic, formerly known as Corrections Corporation of America. And a federal judge says one of the first Dreamers to be arrested during an immigration raid under President Trump has the right to challenge the government's actions. Danielle Ramirez Medina had permission to live and work in the United States under the DACA program, but authorities revoked his legal status after the raid in February. The government argued it can terminate someone's DACA at any time for no reason, but Ramirez claimed his due process rights were violated. On Wednesday, Judge Ricardo Martinez refused to dismiss the case, saying, quote, the representations made to applicants for DACA cannot and do not suggest that no process is due to them, particularly in Ramirez's case where benefits have already been conferred. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We begin today's show in Beijing, where President Trump is in talks with Chinese leader Xi Jinping following a lavish welcome on Wednesday that was billed as a state visit plus and included the first state dinner for a U.S. president inside the Forbidden City. The welcoming ceremony outside Beijing's Great Hall of the People was broadcast live on state television, unprecedented treatment for a visiting leader. Trump used the talks to call on China to sever ties with North Korea.
The United States is committed to the complete and permanent denuclearization of North Korea. So important. China can fix this problem easily and quickly. And I am calling on China and your great president to hopefully work on it very hard. I know one thing about your president. If he works on it hard, it will happen. There's no doubt about it. They know.
Before arriving in Beijing, Trump used an address to the National Assembly in Seoul, South Korea, to deliver a stern message to China, North Korea's biggest trade partner. North Korean state media responded in a statement Wednesday saying the United States should, quote, oust the lunatic old man from power and withdraw its hostile policy in order to get rid of the abyss of doom. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, China insisted it is already fully enforcing UN sanctions. This is Chinese President Xi Jinping.
Regarding the Korean Peninsula nuclear issue, we reaffirm that we are staunchly committed to realizing the denuclearization of the peninsula and upholding the international nuclear non-proliferation system. Both sides will continue to strictly enact all UN Security Council resolutions, and at the same time, we are committed to continuing to solve the North Korean nuclear issue through dialogue and talks.
During President Trump's China visit, the leaders of the world's two largest economies discussed their trade deficit. On the campaign trail, Trump bashed China's trade policies, once accusing China of raping the United States. This is Trump then.
We have a $500 billion deficit, trade deficit with China. We're going to turn it around, and we have the cards. Don't forget, we're like the piggy bank that's being robbed. We have the cards. We have a lot of power with China. When China doesn't want to fix the problem in North Korea, we say, sorry, folks, you got to fix the problem. Because we can't continue to allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing.
So that was President Trump on the campaign trail when he was, well, just candidate Trump. On Wednesday in Beijing, he struck a more conciliatory tone.
Right now, unfortunately, it is a very one-sided and unfair one. But I don't blame China. After all, who can blame a country for being able to take advantage of another country for the benefit of its citizens? I give China great credit. But in actuality, I do blame past administrations for allowing this out-of-control trade deficit to take place and to grow.
Roughly $250 billion in deals with U.S. companies are expected to be announced during Trump's visit. Human rights activists and even Trump's fellow Republicans have urged him to use his trip to challenge China over its crackdown on dissidents and call for the release of political prisoners. Senator Marco Rubio and Congressman Chris Smith issued a statement urging him to raise the forced isolation and ongoing surveillance of the wife of the late Nobel laureate Liu Xiaobo. Since arriving in China, where Twitter is banned, Trump has tweeted at least five times. A White House official said Trump would, quote, tweet whatever he wants. Trump is on a five-nation tour in Asia and has already visited South Korea and Japan. He goes next to Vietnam, where he's expected to meet with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, and then on to the Philippines. We're going now to Beijing, China, where we're joined by Joanna Chu, China correspondent for Agence France-Presse. Joanna, it's great to have you with us. Can you talk about the significance of Trump's trip to China and also talk about the reaction of the Chinese people to the American president?
Right. So thanks for having me. It seems like Trump's visit, his first visit as president to China, has gone without a hitch. As you said, he had a very lavish welcome. He was the only foreign leader in recent history to dine in the Forbidden City Palace. And today he's wrapping up another state dinner with President Xi, where he showed a video of his granddaughter Arabella singing in Mandarin Chinese. And that went over well. So as far as we can tell, the visit was successful. And Trump and his counterpart seem to have reached some consensus on some of the big issues that have been points of tension between the two countries. I think a highlight was trade. Some reporters were surprised at the tone that Trump gave during his remarks today. While it was softened from what he was like during the campaign trail, it was quite tough. At the same time, he also lavished a lot of praise on Xi Jinping, and the two leaders seemed very comfortable around each other. So it seems like it went well. As he said, human rights wasn't brought up as a focus. Neither was the climate. So it seemed like the talks focused on trade and on what China and U.S. could do on the North Korean nuclear peninsula issue. As far as the reception from the Chinese. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Joanne, I wanted to ask you, just to put this into some context, why is it that China has granted Trump such an extraordinary, in fact, unprecedented welcome, including a state dinner in the Forbidden City, the first time a U.S. president has received such treatment?
Yeah, so reporters did ask that question yesterday to the foreign ministry in Beijing, and they said that it's what a host country should do. They said that Trump received a similar lavish welcome from the Japanese before he came to China. So that's how they addressed why he got this big welcome.
And explain what the Forbidden City is.
So the Forbidden City, it's right in the center of Beijing. It's right in the center. It's where emperors for different dynasties had their center of power. So it's a very symbolic place, and it's unprecedented that they would shut down the whole thing. It's a big tourist attraction to host the president and Melania.
To say the least, it's a different tone that he is adopting. I mean, it's not just tone. He talked about China raping the U.S. on the campaign trail, fiercely went after China, and now said it's not actually China's fault. He understands why a country would take advantage of another country on behalf of its own people. He blamed past administrations, clearly the Obama administration. Can you talk about your thoughts, too? A good deal of applause when he said that.
Yes. Yeah, that was quite an unexpected and cheeky statement. It wasn't as harsh it was he was like earlier, but it was quite tough. And people were clapping, but in a quite an awkward way. They were surprised by the tone he had.
In fact, Trump had repeatedly attacked China at one point, saying, "I'm going to instruct my Treasury Secretary to label China a currency manipulator." So what do the trade talks mean right now? What is Trump trying to get? Trump, who seems to be at his weakest level in this year in terms of popularity in the United States.
Well, he's
States,
trying to reduce
President
the trade
Xi
deficit
has
the U.S.
consolidated
is currently
power.
Running with China at as much as $350 billion. And the $250 billion in the U.S.-Chinese business deals that were signed today, analysts say they're not going to do much to reduce this really big trade deficit.
Well, I was just asking that question about Trump at his lowest popularity in the United States now, at a time when President Xi has consolidated power. And if you can talk about President Xi in China, how he is seen, and what this him being at his point of greatest strength right now is all about. We're talking to Joanna Chu, who is the China correspondent for Agence France-Presse.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Joanna, we can hear you. I was just asking about the—can you hear me now, Joanna? We'll go to a break and we'll come back. We're talking to Joanna Chu in Beijing, China. She is a China correspondent for the Agence France-Presse. Stay with us.
Lying in the dark with your shadow hanging over me, shaking the ground, your footsteps calling.
by Run River North. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We're speaking about President Trump's visit to China right now, part of his five-Asian nation trip. He's headed on to Vietnam, where he may be meeting with the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, and then to the Philippines. We're joined in Beijing, China, by Joanna Chu, who's the China correspondent for Agence France-Presse, for AFP, and Rajan Menon, professor of political science at the Powell School at the City University of New York, senior research fellow in the Saltzman Institute of War and Peace Studies at Columbia University as well. Professor Menon, let me put that question to you about Xi at his greatest strength right now, the president of China, and Trump at his weakest point in popularity and how he's seen within his own party. The elections just took place, a referendum on Trump, and he lost badly.
Morning, Amy. There is quite a contrast. As you know, last year there was a party, last month there was a party Congress in China. Xi came out in a very powerful position. There is now something called Xi Jinping thought. Contrast that with Mr. Trump. The last I looked, his popularity rating is around below 40%. The Russia controversy continues to dog him. There's no legislation that he's gotten through Congress. So it is a significant contrast, no doubt.
And, you know, on Tuesday, Trump told, when he was speaking in Seoul, he said that the U.S. stands ready to attack North Korea over its nuclear weapons program. The question is, and now he's just been in China, how much leverage does China have on North Korea, and what does Trump expect from China?
To hear Mr. Trump say it and the American foreign policy establishment say it, you would think that if Xi Jinping picked up the phone and called Kim Jong-un and said, I want you to dismantle your nuclear facilities, he would do that. That is a complete myth. For one thing, there's an enormous amount of bad blood between North Korea and China. And the tougher China is, and we are, on North Korea, the more likely they are to hang on to their nuclear weapons. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the Chinese already voted for the very tough UN sanctions in August and September. 96% of North Korea's trade is with China, but the Chinese don't want to asphyxiate, to choke the regime to death for fear that it will collapse. That collapse would have immediate consequences for them, economically and strategically. For one thing, in the long term, they, the Chinese, cannot exclude the possibility that a collapse in North Korea would mean down the line a unified Korean peninsula aligned to the United States.
Joanna Chu, you're speaking to us from Beijing. You're covering extensively President Trump's trip. How is North Korea seen in China?
So the Chinese see North Korea as their neighbors, and generally the Chinese have a pretty favorable view of people they share a border with. There is a lot of concern about all this nuclear rhetoric. And China has said repeatedly in response to criticism from the U.S. and other international bodies that it completely, faithfully implements the U.N. Security Council resolutions, including sanctions. And these sanctions, as you know, has increased in the past year. What we don't know, because there are no independent checks at the borders, is how well China really is reinforcing these sanctions. For example, just anecdotally, I visited the border with North Korea a couple months ago, and people there told me that they still get gold and silver from North Korea, even though it's been long banned under the UN sanctions. And just a few weeks ago, I went to some North Korean restaurants in Beijing and asked about their business, and they said every day they get seafood imports from North Korea to Beijing, and that's also against the sanctions. So it's unclear how well China is enforcing, but definitely China is saying they're doing all they can, and their tone is that they should not be the ones who shoulder all the blame. They want the U.S. to reduce its more inflammatory rhetoric against Kim Jong-un and his regime in order to bring all parties back to the negotiating table.
And Joanna, could you very quickly, you've been writing about this, the human rights situation in China now under President Xi Jinping?
Well, it's quite severe under Xi Jinping's first 5 years as president. We've seen an unprecedented crackdown on people in civil society, from lawyers to bloggers to journalists to primary school teachers. It's ironic that Trump is tweeting while he's inside China's firewall, but people in China have been arrested just for social media posts they put on Chinese websites that are a little bit critical of the government. And recently, just this week on Tuesday, a really famous veteran pro-democracy writer, Yang Tongyan, he passed away of brain cancer on medical parole, so he was still in police custody. And this is the pattern that we've been seeing, that dissidents are being jailed and then...
Joanna Chu is speaking to us from Beijing, China. We just lost her satellite, lost it at the bottom of the hour. China correspondent for Agence France-Presse, Raja Menon, still with us, professor of political science at Powell School at City University of New York. If you could continue what she was saying, this issue of human rights in China right now. It's very interesting that here is President Trump lauding President Xi in China, while at the same time the Trump administration has just cracked down on Cuba and made it extremely difficult for individuals to visit Cuba, reversing the thaw in relations that President Obama had initiated.
There is a very big contrast between the tone and the demeanor that Trump struck in South Korea and in Japan compared to China. He clearly does not want to do anything at all to embarrass Mr. Xi. He did not meet with dissidents. He didn't bring up the issue of human rights. He soft-pedaled, as you noted earlier, the trade deficit. And so I would say from the Chinese standpoint, this summit has gone very well for them. Less so, I think, for Mr. Trump.
And the significance of President Trump going to Vietnam tomorrow, and if they work out the framework, I think that's the terms they're using, he will be meeting with the Russian President Vladimir Putin in Vietnam.
Correct. Well—
And the role Russia could also play with North Korea.
Correct. The Russians can play a role, but much less of a role than China, as I pointed out. 96% of the trade that North Korea does is with China, but the Russians do have a residual influence. But much more importantly, Russian and Chinese views are closely aligned. But it is to China that he's looking.
Finally, the significance from your perspective of this trip that President Trump has made. I mean, we know that when President Xi was in Florida, he made a deal with Trump's daughter, with one of his advisors, Ivanka Trump, giving her exclusive copyrights on various of her products being sold in China. The significance of any kind of business deals being made. We know Trump famously yesterday, in the middle of his address to the South Korean Assembly, where he was talking about taking on North Korea. And of course, the threat of war with North Korea is more extreme than it's ever been. He talked about his golf course in Bedminster, New Jersey.
There are business ties between the Trump Corporation and the Chinese. You mentioned Ivanka Trump. The Trump Corporation itself has about 123 trademarks. There is a building in New York of which Mr. Trump is part owner, where the Chinese National Bank has lent about $950 million. So there are such ties. I think that those are not the things that are driving Trump. I think he wants some progress on the trade front. He wants some progress on the North Korean front. He's gotten really not very much of either.
Is there anything you'd like to add, Professor Menon, on the significance of this overall Asia trip that he's taking?
Yes. One of the things that was interesting to me is that he was much tougher on the Japanese when it came to the trade deficit. Now, their trade deficit with the United States at the end of last year was about $70 billion. With China, it was $350. That is five times as much. Yet he treated the Chinese pretty much, as you pointed out, with kid gloves. It was much tougher on the Japanese. He told the Japanese, why do you just import cars into the United States? Why don't you make them here? Well, the Japanese make 4 million units of vehicles here, and they have about 24 manufacturing plants. So the contrast between how
he— United States.
Correct. So the contrast between how he dealt with the Japanese on the trade issue and the Chinese, I thought, was very telling.
Also selling billions of dollars of weapons on this trip.
Correct. Correct.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Rajan Menon, a professor of political science at the Powell School at the City University of New York, senior research fellow at the Saltzman Institute of War and Peace Studies at Columbia University. When we come back, a humanitarian crisis in Yemen, cholera, famine, war. We'll speak with a woman who founded a news agency there but had to leave because of death threats and now reports in exile about her home country. And we'll talk about what's happening in Saudi Arabia as the prince consolidates power, as many people are arrested, and Saudi Arabia continues to bomb, with U.S. support, Yemen. Stay with us.
There's a toilet on the roof. roof in the skies don't care. Blood enemies and holy fools in the skies don't care. We're burning down in flames in the skies don't care. We're sucked in this game in the skies.
Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Yemen, which United Nations officials say will face the world's largest famine in decades if the Saudi-led coalition refuses to lift its blockade on deliveries of aid. On Monday, the coalition shut air, land and sea routes into Yemen after Houthi rebels fired a missile that was intercepted near the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Saudi Arabia says its blockade is needed to stop Iran from sending weapons to the rebels. UN aid chief Mark Lowcock warned that if the blockade is not lifted, the resulting famine will claim millions of lives. He was speaking to reporters after a briefing at the Security Council.
There will be a famine in Yemen. It will not be like the famine that we saw in South Sudan earlier in the year, where tens of thousands of people were affected. It will not be like the famine which cost 250,000 people their lives in Somalia in 2011. It will be the largest famine the world has seen for many decades, with millions of victims.
The UN says aid agencies were given no prior notice of the Saudi decision to shut down all land, air, seaports in Yemen. The World Food Programme said Monday, out of Yemen's population of 28 million people, about 20 million, quote, do not know where they're going to get their next meal. Meanwhile, medical experts warn the clampdown will worsen Yemen's cholera epidemic, which has sickened more than 900,000 people. For more, we're joined by two guests. We're going to begin with Afra Nasser, award-winning independent Yemeni journalist, founder and editor-in-chief of the Sana Review. Facing death threat, she's in exile from Yemen, but continues to report on human rights violations, women's issues, press freedom there. She's here in the U.S. to receive the International Free Press Award from the Committee to Protect Journalists. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Afra. I was wondering if you could start by talking about this blockade, talking about war, famine, and cholera in your country, Yemen.
It's an extremely dire situation. Like, even before this total blockade, there were many reports that every 10 minutes there is one child getting killed because of the implications caused by the war, such as, you know, the total collapse of the healthcare system. There was a partial blockade imposed on many entries in Yemen for more than 1 year that really exacerbated the humanitarian situation because of the lack of access for, humanitarian operations to operate in the country and to send humanitarian aid and send medicine and food. And so even before this total blockade, there was a partial blockade that impacted all aspects of life. So the recent, over the weekend, the decision by Saudi Arabia or the Saudi-led coalition to impose a total blockade means a death sentence that will kill all Yemenis. If we used to warn about a looming famine, it is already there. Now we will not even hear or listen or know anything about what's happening on the ground. The journalists are whether behind jail, international journalists are not able to have an access to the country. So it's going to be like it's beyond tragedy that doesn't even caught world's attention because of the blockade and the impossible access for journalists to report from there.
Well, Afra Nasser, on Monday, you tweeted, quote, "I woke up reading a message from my family in Sana'a. All entries to Yemen are closed. We will die. We will die." Now, your own mother is in Sana'a and other relatives of yours, whom you're in touch with regularly. What do you hear from them?
Most of my family are in Sana'a, and my story is not an exception. Death is the new norm in Yemen. Every household have been impacted by the war. They have one cousin or one brother or one relative who died because of if it's not under the Saudi-led airstrikes or the shelling of the Houthi and Saleh forces in Taiz and other disputed areas, the shortage, the extreme lack of medicine and food and healthcare have. You know, I've lost count of how many relatives that I know, or friends of friends, and relatives of my friends who died because of the implication caused by the conflict. Myself, I lost my aunt 2 years ago. Just last week, I lost also another two relatives, distant relatives, and all were not victims of the airstrikes, but they were victims of the blockade and the shortage in medicine and the total collapse of health care. When I got my message, that message from my mother, it was like a pleading message to the world. She knows that I get an access to speak to international media, and she wanted to tell the world that nobody will know what is happening to us, and we will die and in a silent death because of this total blockade.
And Afra Nasser, since you've been here yesterday, you met with Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut. You've been meeting with officials here in the U.S. What are you telling them? What do you think needs to be done? What should the U.S. position be?
I think the U.S. administration, actually, to be honest, it's hopeless with the White House. And our only hope is with the Congress and the senators who have better sympathy to where the situation in Yemen. And no question that the U.S. has its hand in what's going on in Yemen. They are participant in creating, you know, the world's largest humanitarian crisis. They are participant in creating the largest famine that we will see that the U.N. official was talking about earlier. I think the U.S. administration has to admit that it is giving its political backing to the Saudi-led coalition. It is giving its support with the arms sales and the intelligence and logistic assistance to the military operation. Plus, even with this total blockade, the U.S. Navy has about 80% control over the ports to Yemen. So absolutely, this is what's going on in Yemen is absolutely relevant to the U.S. administration. From my meeting so far, there have been some positive feedback because, you know, as a journalist, I was able to meet them and talk and report like firsthand to them. But that is not, like a privilege that other journalists get. If it was not for the support from Committee to Protect Journalists, I wouldn't have that chance to give like a firsthand narrative to what's going on to my family and friends and everyone that I know in Yemen.
Well, Afra Nasser, on the question of arms sales, the independent newspaper in the UK reported recently, this week, in fact, that the country's sales of bombs and missiles to Saudi Arabia have increased by almost 500% since the Saudi bombing campaign of Yemen began. The U.S. and the U.K. remain the largest suppliers of arms to Saudi Arabia. Could you talk about that and what you think the U.S. and the U.K., what can be done to stop these arms sales or at least to limit them?
That sounds really shocking, but to be honest, for me, I was not surprised when I read the reports. Just like 1 week or 2 weeks ago, there was a report that the UK General Secretary, was State Secretary, was giving a talk at a hearing saying that our criticism to Saudi Arabia human rights record would definitely harm our arms sales to them. So absolutely, there is a double standard from Western government like the UK and the US and others that, you know, once their ally have the money and the cash, they will have disregard to the human cost that these weapons or how these weapons could be used to commit war crimes. This is absolutely like a double standard that Yemenis themselves know or understand better than everyone, that their blood costs nothing, their lives don't matter in face of the cash coming from Saudi Arabia or other members in the Saudi-led coalition, such as United Arab Emirates. I live in Sweden, and I'm working right now on an article that exposed the arms sales from Sweden to the United Arab Emirates. Believe it or not, there is like a military a weaponry office and semi-factory in Abu Dhabi in United Arab Emirates. And I can imagine that living in you know, thinking that in Western countries there are a lot of lecturing about the human rights and respect for democracy values and so on. But once it's a country that is only fault that it's poor, so there is no there is disregard to the human cost that such an arms deal could accomplish on the ground.
Afrin Nasser, let's go to a clip of an Al Jazeera reporter questioning the UN Secretary General's spokesman on the Saudi blockade.
Does the UN believe that by its actions, this blockade, that Saudi is in breach of international humanitarian law?
I'm not in a position to issue a legal ruling. What we do know is that the blockading of ports and airports and land routes can have a tremendously negative impact on a situation which is already catastrophic.
So, Afrin Nasser, your response to the UN Secretary General spokesperson?
I'm not surprised. I'm sorry.
Do you think he should have named Saudi Arabia specifically and said that Saudi Arabia was responsible for the devastation of Yemen today?
Actually, there are many participants in what's happening in Yemen. Absolutely, it's Saudi Arabia and the members of the Saudi-led coalition and also other Western countries that are directly involved in, you know, the military operation. So all these countries have responsibility to to uphold the human well-being before the political and military gains that they are looking for. It's been more than 3 years now with no military gains made by either one side from the warring parts. So this war sounds insane, actually.
So I want to go to the blockade happening this past weekend. And right about the same time, well, last week, Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law and senior advisor, who's now with him in China, went to Saudi Arabia. Then soon afterwards, Saudi authorities arrested scores of prominent officials over the weekend, including 10 princes, 4 ministers, dozens of former ministers, in a massive shakeup by King Salman aimed at consolidating power for his son, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the main architect of the kingdom's war in Yemen. Among those arrested, Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, one of the world's richest people with an estimated net worth of something like $17 billion. Talal has investments in many well-known U.S. companies like Apple, Twitter, Citigroup, and Rupert Murdoch's media empire, News Corp. The arrests unspecified corruption charges. They said it was about corruption. Coming just hours after the Crown Prince convened a new anti-corruption committee with wide-ranging powers to detain and arrest anyone accused and to search their homes and seize their assets. The arrest came as the White House said President Trump called King Salman to offer thanks for the kingdom's purchases of billions of dollars in U.S. weaponry while praising what it called the kingdom's modernization drive. After these arrests and the consolidation of the prince's power, Trump tweeted his support for the Saudi arrests, writing, "I have great confidence in King Salman and Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. They know exactly what they're doing. Some of those they're harshly treating have been milking their country for years," Trump tweeted. So I want to turn to Toby Jones, who is associate professor of history and director of Middle Eastern studies at Rutgers University, author of Desert Kingdom, How Oil and Water Forge Modern Saudi Arabia. He is joining now Afra Nasser in this conversation. Toby, what's happening in Saudi Arabia? And how does this purge and consolidation of the prince's power, who runs the war in Saudi Arabia, relate to this intensification of the war and blockade in Yemen?
Well, let's start with a basic argument that I've made and others have made over the last couple of years, and that it's clear from Afra's commentary, as well as Saudi Arabia's extensive intervention in Syria, its attempt to destabilize Lebanese politics more recently, its occupation of Bahrain, as well as this mobilization to consolidate bin Salman's power at home, which has not just started recently, but is really part of a two-year project, that Saudi Arabia is the most dangerous actor in the Middle East. It's also clear that from the very from the steps that have been taken over the weekend, that bin Salman is attempting to legitimize himself as the next in line to throne. He's a very young junior member of the royal family. His father will likely abdicate power. He's certainly carving out an imperial presence for bin Salman within the Saudi system. But that he's weak. He's vulnerable. He sees these senior princes as either economic rivals or as potential political problems. He's very cleverly used the language of modernization, anti-corruption, reform, and even feminism to situate himself as a kind of progressive thinker. These are all masks to mystify his efforts to consolidate power and to purge potential rivals.
Talk about feminism. Yes, right before this, they said women in Saudi Arabia will now be able to drive.
He also announced the end, or at least the lifting of certain restrictions on guardianship around women. I mean, if we think about the way Americans and others in the West consume news out of Saudi Arabia in particular, one of the third rails of Western politics when it comes to thinking, and this includes liberals and others alike, is that we really make sense of Saudi politics through the lens of gender and gendered politics. And the oppression of women, their apartheid status in Saudi Arabia, really rises to the top of how we think about, at least critically, about Saudi politics. So when bin Salman lifted restrictions on women, when he finally said that women would be allowed to drive either later this year or earlier next year, it was celebrated in the West. And I think bin Salman was very calculating in both when he made that decision and why he made it. And it was an effort to create space for him to behave in a more authoritarian manner in other sectors.
Well, Toby Jones, you just said that Saudi Arabia is the most dangerous actor in the Middle East. Of course, that's not the position that the Trump administration takes. When Saudi Arabia recently released documentation showing that a missile launched into the country in July by Yemen's Houthi rebels was an Iranian Qaim, on Tuesday, U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Nikki Haley issued the following statement, quote, "By providing these types of weapons to the Houthi militias in Yemen, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is violating two UN resolutions simultaneously. We encourage the release of any information that will help to hold Iran accountable for its support of violence and terrorism in the region and in the world. The United States is committed to containing Iran's destabilizing actions and will not turn a blind eye to those serious violations of international law by the Iranian regime." So, Toby Jones, can you respond to that and the relative role that Iran plays in the region versus Saudi Arabia?
Let me start with the second question, Nermeen. I think that there was very little evidence before 2015, 2016, that Iran had much of the way of influence in Yemen. It's part of the narrative here and elsewhere that the Houthis, those sort of mounting the most resistance to the Saudis in southern Arabia, are Iranian backed. There's very flimsy evidence for that. Now, more recently, Iranian weapons have made their way into Yemen and into the war there, but it's unlikely that the Houthis are taking marching orders from Tehran. This is a talking point from Saudi Arabia to legitimize their terrible war there. On the question of Saudi Arabia invoking the language of terrorism to frame Iran's meddling and the danger that Iran poses in the region, I mean, that's pretty rich coming from Saudi Arabia, which did everything it could to sustain Syria's civil war, including the backing of al-Qaeda-backed and linked militants there in their campaign against Assad. It's also pretty rich that the Saudis would wage a war against Yemen for over 2 years and then express both shock and outrage and invoke international law when they're, you know, sort of realizing that the Yemenis are fighting back. It's a pretty, you know, it's irony is perhaps not the right way to make sense of Saudi politics, but they're certainly ambitious and bold in trying to redirect what the underlying forces are, which they're most directly responsible for.
Afer Nasser, we're talking about your country. You went into exile in Sweden facing death threats. You were about to win a major award from the Committee to Protect Journalists for your bravery in reporting in Yemen. Your mom and a number of members of your family are still there. What is your reaction to the consolidation of power of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, who is in charge of the bombing campaign in Yemen, and particularly being here in the United States right now, which is providing so many of the weapons? And President Trump, of course, making his first foreign trip was to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. For a lot of Yemenis, they understand that the policies by the Crown Prince Salman had disastrous impact in their country. Yemenis also understand that, this leadership, the Saudi leadership, thinks it's losing face. Because it's been 3 years without any military gains or political gains, and such moves, Yemenis understand that such moves like the women drive allowance and also the economic aspiration with building like a mega city, there was a national Saudi robot that was reported on 1 week ago or some time ago. Yemenis understand that such PR moves from Saudi Arabia and the Crown Prince policies are only just to hide the failure, the unfolding in the Yemen war so far. And this should also make the world really understand that no such PR moves from the Saudi leadership should ever get our focus away from the tragedy and Saudi sharing responsibility on the tragedy unfolding in Yemen. So Yemenis really understand that they are, facing the disastrous foreign policy from Saudi Arabia that they have never seen before from their neighboring country.
Toby Jones, very quickly before we conclude, we have 20 seconds. Is there now a risk of a direct confrontation between Iran and Saudi Arabia?
They've failed, as Afra said, largely in their Yemen war. They'll neither mount a military campaign in Lebanon, although they may try to destabilize it internally, nor seek to confront Iran directly, though they sure would like others to do it for them, including the U.S.
Well, Toby Jones, we want to thank you for being with us, Director of Middle Eastern Studies at Rutgers University, joining us from Rutgers. And Afra Nasser, independent exiled Yemeni journalist, founder and editor-in-chief of the Sana'a Review. Congratulations on receiving your award from the Committee to Protect Journalists. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for our paid six-month internships. Go to our website for details. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.